strange came up. I don't know if it has anything to do with it either, but I appreciate you keeping your eyes open. Good work tonight, Ricky. Go get some sleep.
Copy that.
As Ananka hung up, Rosario said, Look at this. She held up one of the notepad pages. The white surface was covered by pencil rubbings that brought the indentations in the paper to life. Three lines in three columns. The first column contained strings of characters, the second numbers only, and the third dates. Like in Patterson's notebook, Ananka said.
Yes.
The order of information was different, but otherwise it was the same. Duplicates? Ananka asked. Rosario shook her head. The dates are after the ones in the book. Perhaps Patterson had not had time to transfer them yet. We need to know what they mean. I'll have Shinji help me work on that.
Good.
16.
Once again, Ricky was not ready to call it a night. The Bradbury Brewery wouldn't be closing for another hour, and having a beer to make up for the one he'd had to leave behind earlier sounded like a great idea. He hiked through Patterson's housing tract back to the highway. He'd left his motorcycle next to a building just on the other side of the main road, as the bike would have attracted too much attention if he had ridden it into the woman's neighborhood. As he lifted his helmet to pull it on, he heard the deep rumble of a powerful engine. He looked north down the highway in the only direction he could see, but the road was clear. He moved up to the corner of the building and peeked south. Headlights. A small convoy of them. He grabbed the binoculars from his bag. A police sedan led the parade. Behind it came a big rig pulling a trailer, another police sedan, and finally a pickup truck. The convoy neared his position, so Ricky pulled back around the side and watched it drive by. As soon as the lead sedan came back into view, he realized he'd made a mistake. Though it had roof lights, it didn't belong to the Bradbury PD. Emblazoned on its door were the words, Scholarian Security. Huh. The big rig did not have identifying marks at all, nor did the trailer it was pulling. The third vehicle also belonged to Scholarian Security. Like the big rig, the white Ford F-150 pickup in the rear had no ownership markings. Four people rode inside it, and in the bed a tarp covered what appeared to be a giant rectangular box. A late-night delivery to Scholarian? Perhaps, but why the escort? Did the company experience a lot of hijacking around here? That seemed unlikely, especially within city limits. And what was the deal with the pickup truck? Keep your eyes and ears open for anything weird. Damn it. He really wanted that beer, but the convoy was exactly the kind of thing Ananka would expect him to follow up on. He hurried to his bike, thinking he should be able to make sure everything was on the up and up and still get to the brewery in time for one last drink before closing. Best laid plans. Yates was annoyed. Everything had been going so well for so long. Schedules had been kept, product had been easily obtained, clients had been satisfied, and money flowed in. And then that Patterson bitch had snooped where she shouldn't have been snooping. Thank God they'd caught her when they had, otherwise things would have gone into the toilet quickly. The stuff she'd copied onto that jump drive he'd found on her? Holy crap. That would have earned Yates and his brother and their cousins some serious jail time, not to mention the repercussions for their clients. Yates had thought he'd been pretty sneaky hiding the docs on the Scholarian servers. Hell, for the last few years he'd been right. How Patterson had figured it out he had no idea, but she'd caused him to reconsider the setup, and within 24 hours of her capture, he'd removed everything and put it on a dedicated machine with no access to the web. It made work a bit more difficult, but they couldn't afford someone else stumbling on everything. Patterson wasn't the only problem. In the early hours of that very morning, he'd been informed about the sudden resignation of two of the project's drivers. The thing was, no one resigned from the project. Yates, as the enforcing arm of the organization, had dealt with them himself, placing an incendiary device inside the cab and a second inside the trailer. As of 8:53 that morning, the drivers were no longer an issue. In most places, such a device would be discovered by investigators, but Yates's dad, the chief of police, worked his state police contacts, and any traces of the device had disappeared. Patterson would soon be taken care of, too, just in a more practical, killing two birds with one stone way. Yates checked the rearview mirror. The big rig continued chugging along behind him like it had been since they met up 20 miles south of Bradbury. Transfer night, when the project was most vulnerable, which was why they usually did it in the wee hours of the morning. Not tonight, though. The loss of the two drivers that morning necessitated a speed-up of the schedule so they could get this truck emptied and back on the road within the next hour, a situation that added to Yates's annoyance. And if that wasn't enough to up his blood pressure, his brother Slater wasn't happy with the product the two dead truckers had brought in. That's why Slater and his crew were following in their pickup, hoping the choices would be better on this delivery. If they weren't, there could be problems at the trials, and no one wanted that. When the convoy reached Skellerion, Yates pulled in first, stopping at the gate to the production building.
Harry, he said with a nod to the guard.
Evening, boss. What do we have here?
Hazardous material shipment.
Skellerion security officer Harry Donovan swiped through some info on his tablet computer.
I don't have... It's early. Wasn't supposed to arrive for another few hours, I believe.
More scrolling.
Okay, here it is. I'll let receiving know you're here. Not necessary. Already called. The hazardous materials crew is the white truck behind us, so make sure they get through, too.
Will do.
The guard opened the gate.
Have a good night.
Thanks, Harry. You too. Yates led the convoy to the delivery dock at the back of the building. He parked off to the side, walked over, and sent the two guards in the other car to the front of the building, where they were to return to the security office. He'd rearranged the schedule so that they would be on monitoring room duty during the transfer, ensuring the cameras in all pertinent areas would not be recording. Though he'd been able to hire several members of his and his brother's secret organization into the Skellerion Security Department, not all the guards were his people. Yates entered the building through the loading dock and was met by three other project members who worked for Skellerion, another guard and two warehouse workers. They'd brought several long carts usually used to transport solar panel parts.
Status, he said.
Not counting security personnel, only seven others in the building,
the guard said.
Two up in administration and five maintenance crew. They finished this section already.
And security?
Rounds have been altered per your instructions. We're good to go.
All right, let's make this fast.
Ricky caught sight of the convoy again right before it turned into the Skellerion lot, west side of the highway, the manufacturing side, according to Dylan and Liesl. He pulled off the road 50 yards shy of the business's property line and rolled the bike down into a gully where it would be hard to spot. He hurried into the woods, paralleling the fence along the side of the property and then the back, until he spotted the convoy again near a loading dock. One of the security vehicles was missing, but the other three vehicles were there. A man in a security uniform stood several feet away from the sedan, talking to two men dressed in jeans and light jackets. Every few seconds, the guard glanced toward the loading dock, as if waiting for something. Sure enough, a minute later, a guard exited the building and gave the others a signal. The trio broke up, each jogging in a different direction. One of the men in jeans headed toward the big rig, the other to the pickup, and the security man to the loading dock where his colleague waited. The semi's engine revved twice, and the truck crept forward until the back of the trailer faced the loading dock. With the security guards acting as guides, the big rig backed into place and shut down. This turned out to be the cue for the white pickup, which reversed into the space next to the trailer. Once it had stopped, all four men exited the crew cab. Two headed toward the rear, while the other pair jogged out in front of the semi-tractor. There they spread apart and then stopped.
Okay, that can't be normal.
Ricky took a closer look at the pair through his binoculars. What had caught his attention were the rifles each man carried. M4s. Serious hardware for a solar energy manufacturer. Who were they guarding against? The place was behind a high fence and a guarded gate. The only people they'd likely run into would be other Skellerion employees, right? And at this hour, there couldn't be many of them around. Ricky took pictures of the guards and the two trucks. As he was switching back to his binoculars, one of the loading dock's big doors rolled up halfway. Shadows began moving across the dock into the building, but the trailer hid what formed them. One of the men from the pickup truck moved behind the tailgate, reached over the side, and pulled up the tarp enough to expose the end of the box facing the building.
Come on, dude, help a guy out.
All the guy had to do was push the damn tarp back another foot, and Ricky might have been able to figure out what it was covering.
Obviously, they were going to take something out or put something in. He increased to maximum zoom and waited. As always, the sleeping drug had been pumped into the trailer prior to its arrival at the plant, rendering its human cargo unconscious. Moving the bodies from the trailer to one of the carts was usually the job of the two warehouse workers, but since they were in a hurry tonight, Yates and the other guard lent a hand. Once all the product had been unloaded, Slater examined the haul.
This one, he said.
He placed a hood over the head of a young male who appeared to be in relatively good shape, but not too good. The warehouse workers moved the selection into a waiting wheelchair.
"Keep everyone else in the upstairs holding room," Yates said. "The van will be here within an hour."
As the warehouse workers wheeled the carts away, Slater pushed the wheelchair toward the loading dock, followed by his brother.
Without warning, the man at the back of the pickup stiffened, his gaze now on the loading dock door.
For a moment, nothing happened. Then the older guy emerged, pushing a wheelchair toward the white truck.
"Son of a bitch," Ricky muttered.
A bag covered the head of the person in the chair, but from the way he or she was drooping forward, the person had to be either unconscious or dead. Ricky raised his camera again, this time recording video. Upon reaching the end of the platform, the older guy locked the chair's wheels, then he and the security guard who'd been following him lifted the person out of the seat. They lowered the limp body into whatever was in the back of the truck. When they finished, the young guy waiting at the back of the truck pulled the tarp over the rear again and shut the tailgate.
"You wanted weird, Ananka? I got weird for you."
The guard and the older man talked for a moment. Then the older guy hopped off the dock and climbed into the driver's seat of the pickup. As his younger companion got in, the pair of armed sentries jogged over and did the same. Ricky slipped his phone into his pocket and hurried as quietly as he could back toward his bike, hoping to follow the truck. He could see the southbound highway for most of his return trip and knew the pickup had not gone that way. When he reached his motorcycle, he headed north. With each passing mile he drove without catching up to the other vehicle, his frustration grew. When he hit the 10-mile mark, he pulled to the side of the road. Either the truck had turned off the highway or was driving too fast for him to catch up. Ananka fell into a deep sleep moments after climbing into bed and was floating through a house that looked similar to, but not completely like, her home in Boulder. Birds chirped, and Emma Peel, full to the brim, told her the latest gossip on the neighborhood. The knock on her door wrenched her back into consciousness. She grabbed her pistol off the nightstand, tiptoed to the door, and peeked through the spy hole. Ricky stood in the hall, glancing back and forth nervously.
"You're not supposed to be here," she whispered.
He leaned toward the door and said in a low voice,
"I know, but I gotta show you something."
"Email it to me."
"That would take too much time. Come on, open up."
Worried their conversation might wake other guests, she opened the door and yanked him inside.
"This had better be damn good," she snarled.
"I'm not sure good would be the right word."
He moved past her into the bedroom and sat on the bed. As he pulled out his phone, he said,
"You're gonna want Rosario to see this too."
The anger she'd felt when she first saw him subsided quickly in light of his no-nonsense demeanor. She tapped on the common door, and Rosario opened it within seconds, holding her own gun.
"I heard noise," she said. "We have a visitor."
Ananka nodded toward her bed. Rosario took a step into the room and lowered her pistol when she saw Ricky.
"He's not supposed to be here."
"I mentioned that."
"Should we shoot him?"
Ananka pretended to think about it.
"Not quite yet."
Surprisingly, Ricky acted like he hadn't even heard them. Rosario raised a questioning eyebrow, and Ananka replied with a shrug. They walked over to the bed and sat down on either side of Ricky.
"I was gonna grab a beer after we talked, you know," he said, "just to relax before coming back here. But then, well, I saw something weird."
"Something else weird?" Ananka said.
"I know, right? I'm like a weird magnet."
"What did you see?"
Rosario asked.
"A parade of trucks and Scalarian security sedans."
"A parade?" Ananka said.
"Well, two trucks and two sedans."
"That's not a parade."
"Matter of opinion, but it's not important. It did seem kind of odd, though, so I followed them."
"And what did you discover?" He grinned, held out his phone, and hit play. Ananka's eyes widened at the sight of the person being wheeled out and loaded into the back of a pickup truck.
"Correct me if I'm wrong," Ricky said. "But that doesn't seem like the kind of thing a solar panel plant would produce."
"Tell us exactly what happened."
He did.
"Do you know where the pickup went?" Ananka asked.
"I tried to get back to my bike in time, but I wasn't fast enough. I never found them."
"There might be satellite data," Rosario said.
She hurried into her room and returned a moment later with her laptop. While she set to work, Ricky said to Ananka,
"I want you to take a closer look at this."
He played the video again, this time zooming in on the back of the trailer.
While that reduced the image quality, it wasn't bad enough to make a big difference. He pointed at the shadows moving across the ground just beyond the trailer.
My first thought was that these were the people unloading contraband, you know, like drugs or who knows what. What I think now is that the cargo is people.
And what? They're storing these people at Skellarion?
Could be.
For what purpose?
If they were a food manufacturer, I'd say Soylent Green.
No one laughed, not even Ricky. Rosario let out a breath and looked over at Ananka.
No luck. The only nearby satellite with the correct capabilities will not be in position for another 10 hours. The best I can do is set up an automatic search for when it is overhead to look for white vehicles parked in the open.
Do it, Ananka said, though that would be a crapshoot at best. Rosario returned her attention to her computer.
I took pictures of the men, Ricky said. They were a little far, but maybe we can get IDs off them.
What about license plates?
Ricky showed her a picture of the pickup. No plates.
The big rig had one, though.
Send me everything, Rosario said. I will pass it along to Shinji.
Ananka tried to put all the pieces together. Human cargo, Patterson, Harris, Kyle Scudder, Skellarion.
I know what you're thinking,
Ricky said.
You have no idea what I'm thinking.
Smiling, he leaned back and crossed his arms.
Oh, I know exactly what you're thinking. You're thinking we should go inside and have a look around.
He was right. It was exactly what she'd been thinking.
17. 2:55 a.m. Bradbury was dead asleep, the only people out and about being Officer Harris and one other cop on patrol, and of course Ananka and her team. According to the tracker, Harris was driving through the southeast part of town, while her colleague was doing the same up north in Green Hills Estates. Both were out of the way. Ananka drew two parallel rectangles in the sand, with a line representing the highway running between them, and then looked at Ricky, Dylan, and Liesl. Both buildings have the same camera setup. She dotted the dirt at the appropriate spots on each rectangle, the data collected from her and Ricky's recon before the other two arrived. The only difference we saw was with the guard situation. The west building has four patrolling outside on foot, plus one at the main gate, while the east only has two and one.
And naturally we want to get into the west building, Dylan said with a smirk.
Correct, and we need to do it without anyone knowing we were here, so that means no taking out of guards.
Not even a sleeper hold here or there?
Ricky asked. Not if it can be avoided.
You're taking all the fun out of things.
Ananka glanced at Dylan and Liesl. I think we should go through the east building and take the tunnel between the buildings you guys were told about. Do you have any idea where we'd find it?
We did not see it, Liesl said, but the guide seemed to indicate that it is somewhere in this area.
She drew an oval between the two rectangles, near the northern end. Ananka asked Dylan, is that your sense too?
It is.
Okay, then that's where we'll go. They spent a few minutes working out the plan, divvied up the equipment, and headed through the dark to the backside of the east building's lot. Just beyond the fence was a nearly empty parking area, lit by LED floodlights, no doubt powered by stored solar energy. Unlike at Harris's house, there were no gaps between the lights for them to hide in while approaching the building. And though the cameras were spread apart, they were angled so that their fields of view overlapped, leaving none of the grounds unmonitored. Ananka set Ricky, Liesl, and Dylan to work on creating a way through the fence that didn't involve cutting the chain link, and then contacted Rosario over their comm gear.
We need two of the cameras blacked out for...
She paused, assessing the distance from the fence to the back of the building, and added some padding.
40 seconds should do it. Show me.
Ananka aimed her camera phone at the back of the building. The device was currently linked to Rosario's laptop at the hotel.
This one, Ananka said, zooming in on one of the cameras.
She switched to the other device in question. And this one.
A moment, please.
Ananka scanned the lot, knowing it was nearly time for one of the guards to take a walk across the back. No sign of anyone yet.
Okay, Rosario said. I am picking up several different Wi-Fi networks from the building. Most are pretty weak where you are, but I should be able to... Yes, good, I am in. This will take a few minutes.
Understood. Ananka glanced over at her colleagues. How we doing? The others were working on one of the poles and had already detached the lowest wire bracket holding the fence to it.
A couple more of these and we'll be able to lift it high enough to get under, Ricky said. Should be ready by the time Rosario is.
Ananka caught movement at the far corner of the building.
Everybody down, she whispered.
A guard had come around the side and was now walking along the back of the structure. He was halfway across the back when Rosario said,
I am in security and have control of the cameras. Just give me the word. And Ricky, I believe that means I win.
On a technicality, he whispered.
Ananka watched the guard meander along the structure until finally he reached the other corner and disappeared. If the pattern that she and Ricky had noted on their recon held, they had a good 10 minutes until the next guard showed up.
Let's get that thing open, Ananka said.
30 seconds later, the last bracket came free.
Done, Ricky said, after testing to make sure he could raise it high enough.
Rosario, whenever you're ready.
Hold a moment,
Rosario said.
Okay, blackout in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
As she said 0, Ricky lifted the fence again. Liesl slipped under first and sprinted toward the building. Dylan followed, then Ananka and Ricky. Once they were all at the building and out of the camera sightlines, Ananka whispered into her mic,
You can turn them back on.
Copy, Rosario said. Cameras back online.
Are we all good?
I am looking at a feed from inside the monitoring room. The two men who are watching the screens seem surprised at first, but have relaxed now that everything is working again.
What about outside security?
Both men are still at the front of the building. One is at the main entrance, and the other has stopped by the guard shack at the vehicle entrance. They appear to be unaware that there was a problem.
Keep tabs on them, and let us know when they head back this way.
Copy.
Ananka turned to Ricky.
You're up.
With Dylan providing the boost, Ricky climbed onto a wide ledge sticking out over the loading dock. He leaned over the side and helped pull up the others. From there, they used a pair of pipes that ran up the side to scale the building all the way to the roof. Ricky gave everyone a helping hand at the end of the climb, then asked Liesl and Dylan,
Where to?
Liesl took a moment to get her bearings, said,
This way,
and headed toward the right. The building's roof was curved, not so much that they might slip off it, but enough to be a bit of a hike to the summit. Add to that the fact it was nearly all covered with solar cells, and it meant they had to carefully pick their way through the maze to avoid damaging anything. Spaced evenly down along the apex of the roof were hatches, each about 4 feet in length and 2.5 feet wide. Liesl led them to the one at the north end. From the video Dylan had shot during the tour, Rosario had been able to identify the door's manufacturer and learn they were primarily used for ventilation and could be remotely controlled.
Okay, Rosario, we're here, Ricky said. You want to let us in?
One moment.
A brief pause preceded the whoosh of air escaping from under the hatch as it crept open. When it stopped, the gap was only a bit more than 18 inches wide.
Can you give us a little more space? Ricky said. That's a little tight.
The only way is if you remove a limit bar.
This is fine, Ananka said.
She glanced at Ricky. Find some place to tie off. Ricky removed the rope from his backpack and attached one end to a large AC unit nearby.
All set, boss.
Rosario, Ananka said. How are we looking below?
All clear.
Ananka peeked through the gap before grabbing the rope. Me first, then Liesl and Ricky. Dylan, don't get too bored.
Bored? Sitting here, watching the stars, getting cold? What's boring about that?
Ananka smirked and dropped out of sight. Liesl glanced at Dylan.
No sleeping.
Wouldn't think of it.
She vanished next.
Okay, buddy, Ricky said. If the bad guys show up, kill a couple for me.
That's not funny, Dylan said. Ricky grinned.
I'm not trying to be funny.
He slipped over the edge and lowered himself to the catwalk where Ananka and Liesl waited. He gave the rope a double tug, and Dylan pulled it back through the gap.
Clear, Dylan said over the comm.
Rosario lowered the hatch, sealing Ricky, Ananka, and Liesl inside. Ananka surveyed the space below. This being the middle of the night, only a handful of the overhead lamps had been left on for safety purposes, turning the giant room into a spotty mix of shadow and light. Rows of boxes filled most of the floor, the only exception a clear area to the left.
That seems the most logical place for the tunnel entrance, she said, pointing toward the spot.
I agree, Liesl said.
Rosario, we're ready to go down, Ananka said. Are we clear?
One more minute, please.
While they waited for her, they moved to the end of the catwalk, where a wall-mounted ladder led down to the warehouse floor.
"Cameras are looped," Rosario said, letting them know the feed would show previously shot footage of an empty parking area.
"You can go now."
"Copy," Ananka said.
They climbed the three stories down to ground level and quickly made their way through rows of boxes to the cleared area. Ananka's instincts had been correct. A conveyor belt, at least 6 feet wide, ramped out of a hole in the floor, then leveled off and ended at a boxing station. Ananka peered into the opening, but it was too dark to see more than the faint outline of the conveyor system.
"Shall we?"
Ricky said as he hopped up on the belt.
"I'll check first," Ananka told him. "You stay."
She pulled out her phone and flipped on her flashlight, climbed on the belt and followed the downward slope into the abyss. Though the ramp was steep, the semi-adhesive conveyor belt material kept her from tumbling to the bottom, which would have been even worse than she'd assumed since the ramp turned out to be twice as long as she'd expected. The belt must have gone down at least 25 feet before leveling off. She shined the light ahead. The tunnel was about 4 feet wider than the conveyor, with most of that space on the left side, creating a walkway she guessed maintenance workers used. As for the height, it was about 10 feet tall from the concrete floor to the ceiling, which meant around 7 from the top of the belt.
"Come on down," she said.
She turned her light so that it illuminated the ramp. Ricky came first, with Liesl a few steps behind.
"That was fun," Ricky whispered when he reached the bottom. "I wonder if anyone's ever tried to slide a cardboard box down that."
Ananka turned back to the tunnel and headed into it. Half a dozen steps in, she jammed on the brakes and doused her light.
"Rosario, there's a camera down here."
"Are you sure? I do not see anything in the security system."
"I just flashed my light straight at it, so yeah, I'm sure."
Rosario was silent for a moment.
"No change in the security room. Hang on a moment."
Ananka didn't think they had a moment. Maybe the security guards hadn't noticed the unauthorized light pointing at the camera, but if their system was worth anything, an automatic alert would pop up at any second.
"It is not a security camera," Rosario said. "It is part of production monitoring to make sure there are no problems in the tunnel. It is currently off."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes. You will encounter 8 more before you reach the other end. They are also off."
While Ananka did trust Rosario, she felt uneasy as she turned her light back on and walked past the camera. The conveyor stretched through the gray utility pipelined walls, each section looking the same as the last. Here and there they passed one of the non-operating production cameras. The conveyor seemed to go on forever before the team finally spotted another ramp ahead, ascending to ground level.
"Door,"
Liesl said. Ananka looked to where Liesl was pointing her light. Tucked into a nook along the wall was a door with an attached sign that read maintenance. Ananka motioned for Ricky to check it out.
"Locked," he said. "You want me to pick it?"
"If we think it's important, we can hit it on our way back."
They climbed back onto the belt and headed up toward ground level. Just shy of emerging into the other building, Ananka stopped.
"Rosario, we're at the other side," she whispered into the comm. "Room check, please."
"Stop," Rosario said. "Did you not hear me?"
"Hear you? What are you talking about?"
30 seconds ago, I said do not leave the tunnel. Did you?"
"No, we're still in it, but we didn't hear anything. What's the problem?"
"There are 2 guards in the production room."
"Close to the opening?"
"Not yet, but they appear to be checking everywhere."
Ananka motioned for Ricky and Liesl to move back down the tunnel and then followed them.
"Checking like they know there's a problem, or checking like they're on rounds?"
"What? Rosario,
come in. Can you hear me?"
No response. They moved past the bottom and continued down the tunnel.
"Rosario! Rosario, can you hear me? Rosario!"
"Ananka? Yes, here. Can you hear me?"
Ananka was a good 50 feet beyond where the ramp began.
"Yeah, I can. There were a few seconds there where you disappeared completely."
"Same for me."
Ananka looked toward the tunnel exit, her eyes narrowing.
"You said the guards were checking everything. Did you mean, like, normal rounds, or like they think something's wrong?"
"They do not seem agitated, just thorough."
"That was good."
"They are getting closer to the tunnel entrance, though."
That was not good. If the guards descended the ramp, Ananka and the others would never make it to the other side without being seen, because there was nowhere in the tunnel to hide. Hold on. Not nowhere.
"Ricky," Ananka whispered. "Get that maintenance door open."
The maintenance room turned out to be a large, shoebox-shaped space
with the long dimension running perpendicular to the tunnel. It contained very little in the way of maintenance supplies, though, just a single shelving unit, sparsely populated by cleaners and lubricants and tools. Except for that and a cart at the back of the room piled high with boxes, the rest of the space remained unused. This left few options for cover if the guards decided to come in.
"Keep an ear on the door," Ananka told Ricky. She motioned for Liesl to follow her and headed toward the cart.
Her plan was to move it from the wall so they could hide behind it. As they neared it, Liesl pointed at the wall above the cart near the ceiling.
"Ananka, look."
Mounted there was a black tubular electronic device about 2 feet long. Ananka knew exactly what it was. A Nakamura Systems 8500 signal jammer. Depending on the setting, it had a range between 24 feet and nearly 100. No wonder they had lost contact with Rosario.
"Why would there be a jammer in here?" Ananka said.
"I do not know."
When they reached the cart, Ananka gave it a tentative pull and found it lighter than expected.
"Squeeze around the back and make sure nothing falls off," she said. "I want to move it out a little more."
Liesl slipped between the cart and the wall.
Ananka?
"Not enough room? Here, let me pull—"
"No, you need to come here."
Ananka moved behind the cart.
What the hell?
The cart hadn't been sitting in front of a blank wall. It had been blocking a door. A metal bar lay across the door, held in place by thick hooks, clearly meant to prevent the door from being opened. From the other side.
"Okay, does that seem creepy to you?" Ananka asked,
"because it seems creepy to me."
"Creepy is a good word."
Ananka couldn't help but wonder if this was where the people from the big rig had been put.
"Hey,"
Ricky whispered. Since the jammer interfered with the comm, they could barely hear him across the room.
"What's going on?"
Ananka leaned out around the cart and motioned for him to chill, then turned back to the door.
"Shall we see what's on the other side?"
Liesl nodded. Ananka performed an electronic sweep for any monitoring equipment on the other side. It detected no alarm, but did pick up electronic signatures of 5 cameras that, according to her app, were in sleep mode. She lifted the metal bar from its brackets and eased the door open. The space beyond was pitch black. She shined her flashlight inside. Another rectangular room, this one with 3 doors set at regular intervals along the wall on the left.
"Wait here," Ananka told Liesl, handing her the bar.
She removed her pistol from her shoulder holster and crept inside. She scanned the room with her light and spotted 2 of the cameras. Each was mounted on the wall to the right and aimed at the one on the left, presumably at the doors. She approached the first door and slid the latch free. The door opened onto a sparsely filled storage room. Stacked along one wall were several giant rectangular glass boxes that had one of the long sides missing. She walked over and tapped on one of them. Plexiglass. She took a few pictures but had no idea what the boxes were used for. Ananka moved on to the middle room. At first sight, it appeared to be completely empty. She stepped inside and swept her light through the space. Mounted against each side wall at approximately 7-foot intervals were electric outlets, each with 4 sockets. The outlet boxes were connected to one another via metal conduit. A production room? Where identical workstations could be lined up one after another? If so, it would have a sweatshop vibe. Could that be the big secret? As she snapped more photos, she noticed black scuff marks on the floor under a layer of dust. Not from shoes, but from wheels, like on a cart. She took a few shots of them, too, before exiting and proceeding to door number 3. Ricky pressed his ear against the door, listening for the guards and shooting the occasional glance toward the cart at the back of the room. What was taking Ananka and Liesl so long? He wasn't even sure what they were doing back there. Was Ananka planning on bringing the cart over here to block the door? Or were they going to hide behind it? Sometimes it felt like people didn't tell him anything. Footsteps outside, distant but growing louder. He tensed, and for the umpteenth time made sure the door's lock had been re-engaged. Not that it would delay the guards for more than a few seconds. The steps kept coming, which meant they were definitely in the tunnel. Hopefully they would walk right past the door and head to the other building. Tap, tap, tap. Closer and closer and... The steps stopped right outside the door. Ricky sprinted across the room. Whatever Ananka's plan had been, they were down to 1 option now. Hide behind the cart. As he neared it, he could hear the muted jangle of keys beyond the door behind him. He raced through the remaining distance and slid around the cart to join Ananka and Liesl. Except the only one there was Liesl, standing, much to his surprise, in front of an open door.
You are supposed to be monitoring the door, she said.
Don't need to do that anymore. They're coming in.
As Liesl's eyes widened, Ricky picked up the faint sound of a key entering a lock. He pushed Liesl through the opening, whispering, "Go, go, go!"
He entered right behind her and closed the door until only an inch-wide gap remained. For a few seconds, all was calm, and then a gentle whoosh of air pushed the door against him, signaling the outer entrance had been opened. He heard voices as the two guards entered. Nothing panicky, only the small talk of a couple of guys going through the same motions they did every day. They walked around the room for a few seconds, but never came as far back as the cart. When the door finally closed again, Ricky held his position, alert for sounds of anyone who might have stayed behind. After several seconds, he said,
I think they're gone.
He turned, but Liesl wasn't there. Across the dark room, dim light seeped out of a doorway. He turned on his flashlight and walked over. Both Ananka and Liesl were in the room, down at the other end. Ananka's light lit up what appeared to be several low tables pushed together.
In case anyone is wondering, Ricky said as he entered, the guards are gone.
Okay, Ananka said, not even looking at him.
Okay? Would you have preferred them to join us?
This time she didn't answer at all. He headed across the room to see what was more important than their freedom. What the other two were examining weren't tables, but wheeled platforms, the tops raised a few feet above the floor. They were rectangular, about 5 feet wide and 10 long. The surface appeared to be some kind of polymer, with a deep groove running along each side about 3 inches from the edge. Ricky asked,
So, what are we all enthralled about? It's a platform.
Ananka made a crude measurement of the width of the groove, using the barrel of her gun.
Follow me.
She led them to another room of the same size. Instead of platforms, this one held several stacks of clear rectangular boxes, huge ones. Ananka placed her gun barrel against the edge of the opened end of one of the boxes.
See that? Perfect fit.
Liesl caught on a second before Ricky did.
You think these go on top of the platforms?
Yeah, I do.
Why? Ricky asked. To create monster-sized see-through butter trays?
Cute, but no. They would make convenient mobile holding cells.
Ricky blinked. He hadn't seen that coming.
There would have to be a way to regulate air and temperature,
Liesl said.
There are hose ports under the platform, with hidden vents in the floor, Ananka said. Ricky looked from one woman to the other.
Are you too crazy? Why would anyone use these as cells?
You were the one who suggested they were moving people. Seems like an innovative way of putting several people right next to each other while keeping them separate and still being able to see what each prisoner is up to.
Someone could just push it off, he suggested.
Not if they are drugged,
Liesl said.
They wouldn't need to be drugged, Ananka countered. There's a locking mechanism on the platforms, too.
Ricky stared at the boxes.
You're serious?
What I think is that these things were intended for some other use and adapted.
Jesus, Ricky said. Then where are the people?
The middle room seemed to be designed as a holding space, but it's pretty dusty, so I don't think it's been used for a while. My guess? They don't store anyone here anymore.
Hold on, Ricky said. I saw them unloading people just a few hours ago.
You saw them unloading something, and then loading one guy into a pickup truck. But let's assume it was people. Keeping them here, at an active factory? That seems pretty impractical. But not quite as impractical if you think of this place as a late-night transfer point.
So you think the trucks drop them off here and someone else takes them to their next destination?
I'm saying it's a possibility.
Why wouldn't the truck go straight to this other place?
Could be any number of reasons.
Maybe it is not practical,
Liesl suggested.
Right. Or maybe they want to keep the next destination a secret, and that would be a lot easier to do without a semi-truck showing up.
So where is this other place? Liesl asked.
That's what we need to find out.
And how are we going to do that?
Ricky asked.
I think it's time for a more direct approach.
Surprise, surprise, another quiet night in the bustling metropolis of Bradbury. About the only excitement Harris had encountered on her shift was the purchasing manager of one of the dot-coms drinking a little too much at the cash bar and making a nuisance of himself. Nothing a night sleeping in a holding cell wouldn't cure. Dealing with him had knocked her off her normal schedule, though, and it wasn't until around midnight before she made it to Tasha's house. All the trip lines she'd set were still in place, and a quick look through the windows revealed no indication of anyone having been inside. She still wasn't sure if she should take that as a good sign or not. She had spent the next several hours driving around town, keeping the peace. At 2:45, she turned onto Clearwater Drive and drove past the Collins Inn. Like she'd done every time her rounds took her by the hotel for the last two nights, she checked the parking lot for Sean Ramey's Mustang. Her foot eased up on the gas. The Mustang was gone. It had been there when she drove by about an hour and a half ago. Given the time of night, she'd assumed it would remain there. She turned into the parking lot, thinking maybe Ramey had moved it for some reason. But a search through both the front and back lots confirmed the car wasn't there. Had Ramey left town? If she'd had an early morning flight out of Spokane, leaving in the wee hours would make sense. But from what Harris had learned by quietly asking around, Ramey was supposed to be in the area for several more days. Harris had that same feeling in the pit of her stomach she'd experienced the first night she saw Ramey driving around, that the woman was up to no good. Ramey was supposedly here to look into potential locations for her company, but Harris wasn't buying it. There was something off about the woman. And in light of what had been going on with Tasha, Harris couldn't help but wonder if Ramey was involved. She headed back to the main road, hoping to figure out where Ramey had gone. She glanced south and north. Both directions were devoid of traffic. She went south first, taking the occasional side street as she looked for the Mustang. When the car failed to turn up, she tried her luck to the north, but more disappointment followed. Maybe she did leave town. Harris could check with the night clerk at the Collins Inn, but she thought it safer not to have anyone wonder why she was interested. In the morning, she could make an anonymous call from the payphone at the Brazen Diner to find out. She drove to the end of the block and turned back toward the highway to take up where she'd left off on her rounds. When she reached the highway intersection, she noticed headlights in the distance, coming from farther north. In her line of work, she was well-versed in the differences between automotive light designs. While those heading her way were still distant, she could make out enough to eliminate several makes and models, but not Ford Mustangs. She backed away from the intersection until she was hidden by the building at the corner, then turned off her headlights and killed the engine. She grabbed her bag off the floor, fished around until she found her phone, and after accessing camera mode, pointed it at the intersection. It was a good 45 seconds before she heard the motor, and another 5 when she realized there was not one, but 2 vehicles. Though she couldn't see anything yet, she began taking pictures and didn't stop until after Ramey's Mustang and the nice-looking bike following it had gone by. Harris would have assumed they weren't together, except the bike was driving very close to the car, and if it had wanted to pass, there had been plenty of space to do it. She scrolled through the photos until she found the best one of the Mustang and enlarged it to see inside the cab. As expected, Ramey sat behind the wheel, but Harris didn't recognize the Asian woman sitting beside her or the Caucasian man in the back. No sign of Ramey's friend Caroline, unless she was the one on the motorcycle. Harris brought up an image of the bike. No, the rider was too big to be Caroline, and from the silhouette, likely male. She fired up the cruiser and turned onto the highway. She could see the other vehicle's taillights nearing the turnoff to the Collins Inn, but only the motorcycle went toward the hotel. Leaving her lights off, Harris tried to cut the distance between her and the Mustang, but she was still 3 blocks away when the muscle car turned right and disappeared from sight. Harris raced to the intersection, but the other street was empty. Damn it! She resisted the urge to search for Ramey and headed back to the Collins Inn. Upon reaching the hotel, she spotted the motorcycle parked in front of the east wing. She had no doubt now its driver knew Ramey. Harris found a concealed spot in a lot across the street and waited for the Mustang. When it showed up, Ramey was alone. Harris watched her park and walk into the hotel. Supposedly, Ramey's only colleague in town was her friend Caroline Cruz, but it seemed the woman knew at least 3 others. Yep, definitely something fishy going on. Harris was determined to find out what it was. 18. The guests ate breakfast at the banquet table in the lodge's dining room, choosing from an assortment of eggs, scrambled, fried, and boiled. Sausage, bacon, pancakes, French toast, fruit, yogurt, and cheese and meat spread down the center. Unlike when they'd arrived 2 days before, those present talked easily with one another, recounting events from the previous day, when they had all gone through training on the various weapons and methods they might use when the trials began. As they were finishing their meals, the kitchen door opened, and a smartly dressed man who looked to be in his early 40s emerged. Fit, with a bright smile and perfectly styled short brown hair, he exuded a confidence the gathering's attendees could relate to. He was one of them, a member of the elite, a mover and shaker, a man at the top of the power pyramid.
"Good morning, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to finally meet you. I am your host, Mr. Lean."
Greetings were returned in kind. Even the grumpy Mr. Houston, the slumlord, managed to sound almost kindly. They had all been wondering when they'd meet their host.
"I understand training went very well yesterday," Mr. Lean said.
"I'm happy to hear that. I'm told you're a particularly talented group." He smiled.
"I trust you all had a good night's sleep, because today is not a day to be low on energy."
There were a few chuckles and knowing laughs. Today was the start of the trials.
"Is everyone done with breakfast, or do you need a bit more time before we get started?"
"Hell no, let's do it,"
Mr. Wells said. A few eyes turned to Mr. Wise, who had still been eating when Mr. Lean arrived. When he noticed the attention, he pushed his plate away and said,
"All done."
Mr. Ford, the other slow eater, made a similar gesture.
"Fantastic," Mr. Lean said.
He lifted a bell off the buffet table behind him and rang it. The kitchen door opened again, this time admitting three young men who began removing plates and glasses and serving dishes. Once the table had been cleared, tablecloth included, the servants exited. Mr. Lean took his place at the head of the table, but remained standing.
"I know you are all anxious to get underway," he said.
That was an understatement. A sense of excitement and anticipation filled the room, as if it were the very air they were breathing.
"So let's begin. Today's schedule will be broken up into two parts. This morning, you will put to use your training from yesterday and partake in a series of tests to gauge your individual skill levels. This will make it easier for us to provide help where needed, and to match you to the trophy best suited for you. After lunch, we will commence the first trial."
The men grinned like kids on Christmas morning. Mr. Houston raised a hand.
"How will it work? I mean, do we all go at once, or is it one by one? Is there a time frame?"
"An excellent question. The short answer is, each trial has a different method and time frame. But don't you worry, we'll go over the details of today's event this afternoon before we start. Any other questions?"
There were a few, but all were answered in the same quick, efficient manner. Mr. Lean rang the bell again, and Miss Riefenstahl entered.
"Gentlemen, if you will please follow Miss Riefenstahl, she will take you to the testing facility now."
As the guests filed out of the room, the host smiled in a gracious, happy you're here kind of way. But as soon as he was alone, the grin disappeared. What he and his two cousins had created here amounted to a sociologist's dream on so many levels. Of course, Slater and Yates didn't quite see it that way. They were small-time thinkers who used their portion of the profits to fund the so-called initiatives they thought would bring about their dream of a pure world. It wasn't that the host didn't sympathize with their goal, but he knew the world was too far gone to ever see that dream realized. He humored them because he needed them to deal with the logistics of the trials. What he was interested in was power. Real power. That's what the trials meant to him. Every gathering helped move him that much closer to his goal. Having the cream of the cream participate in the trials gave him a giant lever to manipulate them in the future, when the time came for him to make his move to the top. He walked down the hallway to the basement entrance and placed his fingers against the screen next to the door. The pad scanned his prints and released the lock. At the bottom of the stairs was a second door. This time, the associated pad required his other hand. Again, the lock disengaged, and he passed inside. The lodge had been a resort back in the mid-20th century, catering to families looking to spend a week in the wilderness without having to rough it. It was based more or less on the resorts back east that had sprung up at roughly the same time. Its glory days lasted about 15 years, but it had clung on for another decade, going through a series of ownership changes until it was shut down and boarded up in 1979. In the ensuing years, hunters and adventurers and more than a few transients had found their way inside and stayed for a night or a week or month. The host's late father had come into possession of it in 1992. When he was killed for being the asshole he was, title for the property had passed down to the host. He'd been in college then, having moved away from Bradbury with his mother when he was only 8. After his own company was up and running, he decided it was time to go back. It took a bit of manipulating to convince all those with an interest in his company to see the merits of the move, and it had paid off. No one but his cousins, of course, knew about his ties to the town. That was something he kept secret even now. Upon his return to Bradbury, he spent a lot of cash refurbishing the lodge. He tried to rent it out to other companies for business retreats and the like. Unfortunately, it didn't attract nearly the number of customers he needed. Add to that a few financial setbacks at his company, and he was looking at shutting everything down and selling off the pieces. It was around this time when his cousins had come to join him with their idea for the trials and their projections on the money they could make. They'd underestimated. Each attendee paid $250,000 to be here. That was $1.5 million for the 5-day affair, against an event cost of less than $50,000. Since he was the one providing the location and the initial seed money, he received 55% of the profit, while Yates and Slater split the remaining. To ensure they had enough product for events, extras were brought in, meaning once the monthly trial was complete, they could make even more cash selling the surplus to interested parties outside the U.S. All in all, the host had been clearing $5 million a year and would be doubling that this year. The only reason he didn't close his company was he needed a front. He navigated the maze of basement hallways, occasionally passing through other security doors until he reached the prep room. As expected, Slater was there alone, his men upstairs cleaning the dishes and helping with the morning activities. A small, trustworthy crew was the key to the gathering's success. "Is everything ready?" the host asked. Slater opened one of the equipment lockers and pulled out several items. "Will be." "Problems?" "They think they hit the new one we brought over last night a little hard with the gas. He'll have to be the alternate." As alternate, the man would be used only if one of the other two trophies didn't perform as needed. And if he wasn't needed, he'd have a place in the rotation the next day. "But the other two are good?" "See for yourself." He nodded at a door across the room that led to the prep room. The host walked over and entered the room. Though it was smaller than the one he'd been in, it was more than large enough for the 6 mobile holding cells present. Male trophies occupied 3 of the plexiglass enclosures. 2 were awake and standing at one end of their cells. Though the nearest guy had been cleaned up and given a haircut, there was no removing the homeless aura he exuded. The host had seen enough like him since the beginning of the project to recognize his type. The furtive eyes, the overaged skin, the facial tics, the swaying, the look of resignation. He was white, which saddened the host. It pained him to see how low some people sank when they should have had it all. But a person who was a drain on society was a boon to the project. The man stared at the host for a moment, looked away, and turned back, rocking side to side the whole time. The other conscious man did not share the homeless guy's sense of futility. He pounded the box, yelling, but the host could hear only the dull thuds the man's fists made. This one was of the much more common brown skin. Latino, definitely. The host figured him for Mexican, but the host had been wrong on that front before. Ultimately, it didn't matter. The man was just another illegal, now fattening the host's pockets. At the base of the Mexican's neck, like with the homeless trophy, was the familiar red mark signifying Slater had tagged him with a tracking bug. The third man, as Slater had mentioned, lay on the floor of his cell dead asleep. Another Latino, and young, too, maybe 20 or 21. He was a real find. He'd make an excellent participant and would provide the kind of experience attendees enjoyed the most. Satisfied, the host exited the room. "What about tomorrow's stock?" he asked his cousin. "I'll be heading over to the barn after I'm done here to make the final choices," Slater said. The old barn was behind the host's house near Bradbury and was where they held inventory until it was needed. "I was thinking that tomorrow might be a good day to send in the woman," Slater said. "Maybe the midnight trials?" The host considered it for a moment. "I love that idea."
19.
Rosario grabbed the mobile off the nightstand without looking and pulled it under the covers with her. She checked the screen and hit accept after she saw who it was.
"These had better be good."
"Were you asleep?" Shinji asked. "It sounded like you were asleep. I can call back, but..."
She groaned.
"I am awake. What is it?"
"I ID'd some of the guys Ricky saw at that delivery. I, sent you an email with the details."
"You called to tell me you sent me an email?"
No, that's not why. I got to thinking about the delivery, and it reminded me of the link you sent from the Bradbury Evening Independent."
"What link?"
she asked, still half asleep.
"The one about the accident."
He paused.
"The truck?"
Another pause.
"On the highway?"
"Oh, right."
two trucks in odd circumstances and on the same day, I thought it might be a good idea to see if there's a connection.
She pulled the covers off her head and sat up. That's not bad, Shinji. Is there a connection?
The first thing I did was see if I could get some kind of ID numbers off the trucks, see if maybe they were owned by the same people or came from the same place. It took a bit, but I got them.
Only what?
Well, when I saw the numbers, it reminded me of something else. I double-checked, and it turned out my hunch was right.
Shinji, you are giving me a headache. Just tell me.
Patterson's notebook. The long string of characters. Those are truck IDs. In fact, the IDs for both the burned-out rig and the one Ricky saw are on the list.
She jumped out of bed and hurried over to her computer. Send me the ID numbers.
Already did.
She opened her email program. Any other surprises for me?
No, sorry, that's it.
Do not say sorry, Shinji. This is excellent. You have my permission to call me anytime you have something like this.
Really? Well, okay.
I'll talk to you later.
She hung up and began verifying what he'd told her. Ananka's alarm went off only a few minutes after Rosario's phone had rung. She killed it and lay still for a moment, wishing she could fall back to sleep. But she'd told the others they'd reassemble at Casa de Artista at 8:30, and it wouldn't look good if she showed up late. Plus, she needed to talk to the administrator before she left. She climbed out of bed and grabbed her phone. There have been some developments, she told him after he answered.
Tell me.
We don't have a complete picture of what's going on yet, but it's coming into focus. We're pretty sure the something strange going on you were worried about involves the involuntary transportation of people.
Silence. Then,
explain.
She told him about the very long day she and the team had experienced, ending with their adventure at Scalarian.
If I'm understanding correctly, the human trafficking assertion is still speculation, he said.
Technically, I guess, but it's hard to ignore.
What would Scalarian's purpose be in undertaking this kind of thing?
That's one of the things we still need to work out.
Then I repeat, speculation.
Not for long.
All right, tell me your plan.
Everyone had arrived at Casa de Artista by the appointed time. Dylan had been kind enough to have coffee ready, and Ricky, unprompted, had picked up croissants, donuts, and a big bowl of chopped mixed fruit.
Anybody come up with any ideas why Scalarian might be into shipping people? Ananka asked.
Could be smuggling in cheap labor, Ricky suggested.
We didn't see anyone who looked forced to work there when we walked through, Dylan said.
Do you really think they'd expose you to them?
Maybe not, but I can't believe they could hide something like that from their regular employees. And there'd be no keeping it quiet then, would there?
Dylan was right. The biggest enemy to a conspiracy was the number of people who knew the truth. The larger the group, the more likely someone would spill the beans.
They could have a different facility, Liesl suggested. Off? Away?
Off-site? Ananka asked.
Yes, off-site.
It's possible, Ananka said. Anyone else?
Whatever the reason, they have been doing it a while and at a pretty steady pace, Rosario said.
Ananka looked at her. Rosario had been surprisingly quiet on the drive over, as if lost in thought.
What do you mean? Shinji cracked the code Patterson used in her notebook. The character strings are truck identification numbers. One in the list belongs to the truck Ricky saw. Another belonged to the truck that burned on the highway.
The one we passed? Liesl asked.
Yes.
Ananka stared at her.
How long have you been sitting on this?
He called me not long before we drove over here.
And you couldn't have mentioned something then?
If I did, I would have had to repeat myself.
What about the other numbers on the list? Dylan asked.
I do not know for sure, but it seems likely the dates are delivery dates, and the number could be how many people in a specific delivery.
We should have Shinji track down the other trucks on the list, Ananka said.
He's already doing so.
Damn, Ricky said. Good job, Shinji.
Rosario nodded.
There is one more thing, Ananka said.
The floor is still yours.
The white pickup Ricky saw is owned by a man named Dalton Slater.
You're like Santa Claus, Ricky said. Please tell us you have an address, too.
Of course I do.
Ananka looked at Rosario.
Is that it?
For the moment.
Well, then, I guess in the spirit of Shinji and Rosario, today's the day we find answers.
Ricky grinned.
I like the sound of that. Are we going after the Scalarian guy?
Ananka shook her head.
When they went after Scudder, she wanted to be armed with as much information as possible.
I have some